6. The Constitutional Revolution, Road to a Plural Modernity, 1905-1911. On December 12, 1905, following the closure of the bazaar, a huge crowd gathered at Tehran's Friday Mosque to protest the mistreatment of the city's sugar merchants by the governor of the capital and to demand that the mujtahids of the city come out in their defense. The crowd listened to Jamal ad-Din Isfahani, a middle-ranking popular preacher and a crypto-Babi, who rebuked the governor for his cruelty, warned that the Iranian nation under the aegis of the deserved justice and public security, and called for the lifting of the state's draconian price controls. Further, he declared that both the common law, as enforced by the state, and the Islamic law, as practiced by the mujtahids, must comply with the law, qanun, a notion new to Iranian audiences that implied the constitution. If the Shah is a true Muslim, he stressed, he too must comply with the people's wishes. The demands epitomized the predicament of a revolution that his sermon served to inaugurate. These bold claims were bound to agitate the pro-state ulama. In the midst of Jamal al-Din's sermon, the government appointed the imam of the Tehran Friday Mosque, outraged by the preacher's outspokenness, ordered him forcefully pulled from the pulpit and expelled. Subsequently, the club-wielding government guards rushed into the mosque and drove out the protesting crowd. The next day, some of the ulama who had been present at the gathering and were offended by the government's overreaction left the city in symbolic protest and took sanctuary, Bast, in the local shrine of Abdelazim, south of the capital. The shrine soon became the center of protest, and the population of Tehran came in droves to sympathize with the protesters. The incident marked the beginning of a popular movement that eventually came to be recognized as the Constitutional Revolution, Enkelab-e Mashrateh, a transformational experience with major consequences for 20th century Iran. The previously described episode highlights most, if not all, of the elements that would shape the revolution. Merchants and artisans resentful of an inefficient and intrusive state, the lower and middle-ranking mullahs of various shades calling on the mujtahids to come out in support of the people, the Qajar state's desperate reactions to demands for popular participation and eventually for a constitution, and finally the urban population in large numbers. To these groups were added in due course the Western-educated elite, who joined the indigenous radical elements and helped shape the parliament, Majlis, and frame the modern constitution. The emerging constitutional movement, with its distinctive pluralistic features that allowed for diverse social and political groups to participate, however, soon ran counter to a royalist front that, backed by Imperial Russia, aimed to reassert the power of an autocratic Qajar Shah in power and preserve the privileges of the ruling elite. The revolution also contested the privileges of the very clerical class that first came to its support, but soon changed course as the constitution and the Majlis imposed limits on the mujtahid's sphere of authority and defined the boundaries of the Sharia. The outcome was a multifaceted struggle that helped define Iran's modern national identity, emerging first in the civil war of 1908 to 1909 and continuing in the two decades before the rise of Reza Shah and the establishment of the Pahlavi order in 1925. In these respects, the constitutional revolution was unrivaled in the history of the modern Middle East. Neither the Young Turks Revolution of 1908, nor the anti-colonial movements in Egypt in 1919 and elsewhere in the Arab world after World War I, shared the extent of the constitutional revolution's grassroots base. During the five decades of Pahlavi rule, many of the political achievements of the constitutional revolution would be compromised by the arbitrary conduct of the state. Later, the Islamic Revolution of 1979 abrogated the constitution of 1906 altogether. Yet the constitutional revolution remained a turning point in the history of Iran, above all because it marked a step forward on the path to socio-political modernity. Under the veneer of Western liberalism and constitutional order, the revolution tried to offer indigenous answers to a distinctly Perso-Shi'i problem of social justice that had long been present in the milieu of Iranian descent. In effect, the revolution sought to secularize Shi'i millenarian aspirations by incorporating such modern concepts as nationalism, the rule of law, limits to state power, individual rights, and people's representation. The revolution juxtaposed these principles with the ancient vestiges of kingship and the clerical establishment. The civil war of 1908 to 1909 between the constitutionalists and the royalists was the climax of a revolutionary struggle, for it weakened Qajar rule and relegated, at least temporarily, the conservative clergy to the political wilderness. The turmoil caused by the revolution, however, was compounded by the European threat of military occupation before and during World War I, which brought an abrupt end to the constitutional experiment and dampened revolutionary aspirations. New voices of dissent. Internal dissent on the eve of the constitutional revolution drew on popular discontent from the pulpit of the mosques and through the nascent press and modern schools, but it still relied on voices of protest abroad to articulate its message. Greater exposure to the outside world through education, press, and travel for some Iranian observers augmented Western material advances and in turn bolstered the discourse of decline and renewal, as well as the urgency to adopt what they called modern civilization. Polemical tracts reached the Iranian public less in print form and more through handwritten copies that circulated in dissident circles and influenced the rhetoric and the substance of revolutionary preaching. Based mostly in Istanbul, but also in Cairo, Beirut, Calcutta, Mumbai, and in the Caucasus, the works of this small circle were barely known to the general public, and even the educated elite did not engage in their reformist discourse throughout the Nasseri era. Only by the turn of the 20th century did the reform literature enjoy greater exposure among semi-clandestine circles inside Iran. In particular, despair over Iran's material plight and moral degeneration, and denouncements of the corrupt establishment and the intransigent, found new audiences. The small circle of Iranians abroad consisted mostly of those of heterodox or minority backgrounds who were often in contact with one another and reading one another's works, a republic of letters, of a sort. Their improvised ideas of reform included critiques of the conservative officialdom, but seldom the mojtahed establishment. The alternative models, they suggested, were often based on facile readings of the French Enlightenment or inspired by ideals of benevolent rule, as seen through the prism of Russian authoritarianism. Overall, they were naively praiseful of Europe, though often inconsistent in their quest for modernity. An important area of dialogue centered on education. Reformist literature of the late Qajar era and the constitutional revolution lamented illiteracy and the absence of modern educational institutions, and was critical of the madrasa curriculum and its deficiencies. It also called for a change in the Persian script, one instance of a broader preoccupation shared by reformers in many non-Western societies. The Persian, highly stylized Shekaste handwriting, common in the Qajar era, though undeniably an art form, was viewed as cumbersome for the demands of public education. The lack of modern sanitation and modern medicine, malnutrition, and the absence of an effective public health system to combat outbreaks such as cholera and to control diseases such as smallpox and trachoma were other sources of grievance. Glaring scientific and industrial shortcomings in comparison with civilized countries was the cause of profound concern. Images of decay and deprivation in Iran were contrasted not only to idealized notions of Western material advances, but also to an idealized vision of Iran's ancient past. Only on the model of Western powers, it was argued, and the modern rule of law and constitution, could Iran overcome its rampant maladies. The reformist literature of the 19th century was generally oblivious to Europe's colonial ambitions, and when it wasn't, it often implied that falling under Western imperial might was an inevitable fate of the weaker nations. One notable anomaly with reference to the impending colonial threat was the celebrated statesman Mirza Malcolm Khan, 1833 to 1909. His critique not only showed some awareness of the European threat, but also aspired to adapt to the realities of the Iranian environment and to Islamic mores and values. A man of complex personality, Malcolm's creative mind nevertheless left a lacuna between his high-minded positivist perspective and his self-serving financial interests. His influence on the constitutional revolution, nevertheless, went beyond a mere proposal for the state's reorganization. He considered the reform of the Persian script as key to the transmission of knowledge to the masses. To demonstrate his point, in 1884 he even published in London Sa'di's Golestan in his improvised alphabet. Malcolm's eclectic humanity creed, Adamiyat, inspired by Auguste Comte's positivist religion of humanity, was an extension of his quasi-Masonic Faramushkhane of earlier years. Rising above organized religion, it aspired to the universal values of scientific progress, human rights, and tolerance. He even persuaded Nasser ad-Din Shah to issue a decree similar to the Ottoman 1856 imperial rescript of the Tanzimat period, to recognize for the first time the security of all the subjects' basic rights to their lives and properties. Yet it was the disregard for such measures, rebuked in the pages of the periodical Ghanoun, that began to reach Iranian readers through clandestine channels. In publishing Ghanoun, Malcolm joined forces with Syed Jamal ad-Din Afghani and his cohorts. Expelled from Iran in 1891 at the outset of the Reji protest, Afghani became a vociferous critic of the Qajar state. As much as Malcolm was a prophet of secular modernity, Afghani was a pioneer of political Islam, albeit in the garb of Ottoman-backed pan-Islamic activism, an ideology with little popular support among Shi'i Iranians. What did appeal to Afghani's Iranian audiences, to whom he spoke in Persian, his mother tongue, was a politicized reading of Islam not merely as a set of beliefs and practices, all the tedious works of the Shi'i jurists, but as a community of resistance, a force of unanimity that had already proved effective during the tobacco protest. The message of defying Europe's imperial powers through religio-national solidarity resonated in the Iranian milieu through wide distribution of his famous letter to Shirazi. The clandestine nocturnal letters, Shabnameh, jellygraphs in Iran, also circulated dissident views and were even posted on the mosque's gates and other public buildings. After the assassination of Nasser ad-Din Shah, Afghani acquired greater fame in Iranian dissident circles for instigating the removal of a tyrant who had arrested the course of Iran's progress. That Afghani and some of his devotees were paid agents of another tyrant, Sultan Abd al-Hamid, and that he himself wished to be a sword in the hand of any power that could hire his services, perhaps with the exception of the British, did not seem to tarnish his image even at the end of his life. He died of cancer in 1897 while under house arrest in Istanbul. For the philosopher of the East, as Afghani liked to portray himself, a nostalgic reading of the Islamic past was complemented by a call for religious renewal, for an Islamic reformation, as he called it, that could rescue Muslims not only from the yoke of Christian colonialism, but also from their tyrannical rulers. The odd union of Malcolm and Afghani, prophets of Western modernity and pan-Islamism, anticipated the ideological tension that later riddled the constitutional revolution. The ideological link between these figures and a new generation of Iranian activists at the turn of the 20th century was maintained through the likes of Mirza Aga Khan Kermani, 1854-1897. An original thinker with some zest, he indigenized Malcolm's positivist reformism and borrowed from Afghani his anti-imperialist stance. What he contributed to this admixture of 19th-century Iranian dissent was an ideology of conscious nationalism rooted in the idealized narrative of the ancient Iranian past and set against the gloomy realities of its present. Kermani's nationalism, with its anti-Arab and even anti-Islamic outbursts, underscored a collective destiny and called for the overhaul of Iran's waning moral resolve and cultural orientation. His writings, mostly unpublished, nevertheless came to be an important feature of the constitutional and the post-constitutional intellectual landscape. Kermani's personal makeup contributed to the fluidity of his ideas, but also to his many flaws and his vacillating political orientation. Born in 1856 to an old but impoverished Sufi family with Zoroastrian ties in the religiously diverse city of Kerman, in the remote heart of southeastern Iran, he was an early example of a modern intellectual dissident. His birthplace, a venue of Sufi Ni'amatullahi Sheikhi, Usuli, Zoroastrian, Babi, and Baha'i loyalties, not only helped shape Kermani, but also produced numerous dissidents in the constitutional period. Kermani gravitated toward Babi thought through his philosophy teacher, who also taught him the rudiments of Mullah Sadra's philosophy. His short career as a tax collector came to an abrupt end following a quarrel with the provincial governor, who forced him into exile. The young Kermani eventually landed in Istanbul, where he worked the rest of his short life as a freelance journalist, translator, political activist, and private tutor. Writing for a while under a pseudonym for the Persian popular weekly Akhtar, published out of Istanbul, Kermani's articles addressed current affairs, economy, politics, education, and culture from a critical perspective, but in a veiled language acceptable to the newspaper's readership. By underscoring Iran's socio-political ills, he hoped to reach wider audiences. Displaying symptoms typical of an angry intellectual in exile grappling with an identity crisis, he conceived of a national identity enthralled with the glories of the ancient past, which he had discovered mostly through the Shahnameh, but also through Greek and Roman texts available in French, and the emerging European scholarship on the subject. In contrast, in his later years, he portrayed Arabo-Islamic influence as alien, backward, and responsible for Iran's presumed degeneration and decline. Only by casting aside this dark legacy of prejudice and pollution, Kermani argued, could the Iranians recover their lost purity and, once more, rejuvenate their country. Drastic critique of the Islamic past, it can be argued, could have occurred only in a milieu impregnated with a heterodoxy. Kermani was not a conventional Babi, loyal to the messianic precepts and its proto-Sharia system devised by the Bab in his Bayan, even though, for a while, he did remain loyal to the Azali activist brand of Babism and a passionate supporter of the Azali sectarian battles against the Baha'is. Yet the Babi past served Kermani as an intellectual springboard to come to terms with European modernity. His intellectual profile included not only the European Enlightenment, but also a complex amalgam of materialist philosophy, socialist political programs, and nationalism with a chauvinist bent. It was the renewed subversion against the Qajar state, however, that in 1896 cost Kermani his life, when he and two of his cohorts were arrested and detained by order of the Sultan Abd al-Hamid, who seems to have been alerted of an anti-Qajar conspiracy in the making. After the assassination of Nasser ad-Din Shah, they were duly extradited to Iran as accomplices and executed in Tabriz by the order of then Crown Prince Muhammad Ali Mirza, 1872-1925. Whatever Kermani's role, it was his memory as an anti-Qajar dissident that elevated him to the status of a martyr in the narrative of the constitutional revolution. Despite his curious support for pan-Islamism, Kermani shared anti-Islamic sentiments with another intellectual exile of his time, Mirza Fatali Akhundzadeh, 1812-1878, an Azerbaijani playwright and ardent social commentator who had spent most of his adult life in the Russian civil service in Tiflis. An unabashed critic of all organized religions, and especially Islam, he advocated a rationalistic view of civilization that was the closest a 19th-century Iranian expatriate could come to the deist ideas of the French Enlightenment, albeit via Russian literature. The chief vehicle for this social and moral critique was modern European theatre, a medium new to the Iranian and Azerbaijani audience. Even though Akhundzadeh's plays were published abroad and enjoyed a sizable readership in their original Turkish and later in Persian translation, they were hardly ever performed. A major theme in Akhundzadeh's works, inspired by the simplicity of Molière's plays, was the contrast between the hold of old beliefs and practices, the superstitions, in Muslim societies, and the potency of modern civilizational forces, especially the modern sciences and medicine. More so in his unpublished polemics, Akhundzadeh internalized the positivist critique of Islam and its incompatibility with the demands of the modern world. In fictional correspondence dated 1863 between Kamal Adoleh, an Iranian skeptic writing from Tabriz, and his interlocutor, an Indian Shi'i prince residing in the holy cities of southern Iraq, Akhundzadeh offered a daring criticism of Shi'i beliefs and institutions. He held Islam, its scripture and doctrine, and more pointedly, the Shi'i beliefs and teachings, responsible for Iran's current state of affairs and the root cause of the decline of the Persian civilization. In Voltairean fashion, he ridiculed the idea of divine inspiration, the tales in the Quran, and the force of bigotry and unreason that the Islamic religion and the disastrous Arab conquest of Iran had unleashed on his countrymen. Like Kermani, he also lamented the loss of the great civilization of pre-Islamic Iran. Drawing historical and sociological comparisons with his own time, he chastised Islam for its anti-rational and unenlightened principles, including the ignorance, arrogance, and superstitions of the religious authorities, and for their condoning of slavery, torture, and the mistreatment of women. With lesser intensity, he also held the Qajar state responsible for corruption and mismanagement, and he attacked the undeserved privileges of the elite. Yet in his discourse of decline, Akhundzadeh, who was a great admirer of Russian high culture, barely ever held the European powers accountable for their part. For him, as for Malcolm and most other reformers of the 19th century, the major sources of evil were domestic rather than geopolitical. European imperial rivalry barely drew his attention, and he had little to say about colonial ambitions all over the globe. One could almost read between the lines a cold reality that echoed the message of the old Persian mirror literature: might is right. If Iran was disempowered and subdued by the West, it was not the West's fault. Instead, Iranians, and Muslims in general, had failed to cast aside their threadbare cultural and religious values and embrace Western civilization. Movements of indigenous reform within Shi'ism, too, were denounced by Akhundzadeh. Although he condemned the persecution of the Babis, still fresh in his mind, as barbaric, he treated the message of the Babis and the Sheikhis as merely a reiteration of Shi'i superstitions and yet another obstacle to the march toward civilization. Like Akhundzadeh, the Qajar prince Jalal ad-Din Mirza, another ardent nationalist with whom Akhundzadeh corresponded, viewed the Arab conquest of Iran and its cultural and political legacy as a historical catastrophe that pummeled the superior Iranian civilization under its hoof. Jalal ad-Din Mirza, the former honorary head of Malcolm's Faramush Khaneh, had produced a rudimentary history textbook, presumably for elementary teaching in the Dar al-Funun, the Nameye Khosravan, Book of the Kings, though mostly a facile list of Iranian dynasties, was written in pure Persian, in a simple style and devoid of Perso-Arabic words. Illustrated with imagined portraits of the Persian mythological and Sasanian kings, his was a conscious effort to narrate Iranian history from its legendary origins to the Islamic period. To demonstrate continuity in the Iranian past, there was no significant reference to Islam or the Arab conquest, which, like the Mongol conquests, was portrayed as a dark aberration. Themes of civilization and reform, the need for constitutional recourse, the heritage of the ancient past versus decline in the present, and the critique of conservatives' obstacles to modernity all laid the foundations of the constitutional discourse. They simply had been woken from their dormancy when the economic crisis at the turn of the 20th century needed a language of protest. Economic downturn and merchants' grievances. The assassination of Nasser ad-Din Shah put an end to Iran's political isolation, to which it was subjected by the canny monarch. The accession of the new ruler, Mozaffar ad-Din Shah, almost inadvertently broadened Iran's cultural horizons. He possessed neither his father's panache nor his political skills to pull strings at the court and the divan, or to play the competing European powers off one another to his own advantage. He was a man of gentle disposition, with an earnest desire to open up the country to social and educational reforms. His naivete aside, he tried to break away from the web of Machiavellian politics of earlier years. Yet, to maintain some continuity, he briefly reinstated his father's chief minister, Ali Asghar Khan Amin al-Sultan, who was given the additional title of Atabak, or guardian tutor, even though the new Shah was well into his 50s. Atabak, the sole chief minister of the Nasseri period to escape elimination at the hand of his former royal master, had orchestrated a bloodless transfer of power. Yet he proved helpless in the face of mounting economic pressures, the intrigues of the greedy inner court circle that came with the new Shah from Tabriz, and rising popular discontent. His weapon of realpolitik was no match for the new challenges that loomed large after Nasser ad-Din's death, and he was dismissed later in 1896. The new premier, Ali Khan Amin al-Dowleh, who had long been hailed as a champion of reforms, did not last in office for more than a year either. His program of fiscal, administrative, and educational reforms was the closest a Qajar statesman could come to the lofty ideals contemplated by people like Malcolm Khan. Yet Amin al-Dowleh's dream of reconstructing what he dubbed ruined Iran, Iran Neh Viran, ran counter to the three-headed dragon of foreign interests, court intrigue, and economic downturn, not to mention clerical conservatism. The budding modern schools, inspired mostly by the Ottoman Rashdiye system, were the test case. Advocated by a dissident educator of the Babi leaning, Mirza Hassan Tabrizi, better known as Rashdiye, who had spent years in Beirut and Istanbul, the new schools soon were to meet the clergy's open antagonism. Such mujtahids as Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Najafi, better known as Aga Najafi, the powerful jurist of Isfahan, were at the forefront of opposition. The teaching of European languages in particular was branded as mimicking the ways of the infidels. Modern sciences, geography, and even a new classroom arrangement with chairs, desks, and chalkboards did not fare any better. Droves of madrasa students under the Najafi's thumb ransacked elementary schools and drove teachers out, even forcing them into exile. Even Amin ad-Dowleh's largesse paid to the clerical authorities, a courteous bribe to keep them on his side, did not fully work. Severe financial pressures on the economy, aggravated by sharp fluctuations in the international currency market, further dimmed Amin ad-Dowleh's chances. The secondary impact of the Panic of 1893, the first major U.S. economic depression, which had global consequences by contributing to the collapse in the price of silver worldwide, had a serious impact on the Iranian silver-based currency. Between 1892 and 1893, the value of the Iranian tuman dropped 28%, a staggering fall by any standard. Moreover, the predominance of modern banking and international capital, though less tangible in Iran than in Egypt or the Ottoman Empire, created new obligations for the state and the business community. Yet access to international finance lured the Iranian state to borrow hefty loans in order to pay for court expenditures. The Shah's two royal tours to Europe between 1900 and 1905 in the extravagant style of his father, the expanding bureaucracy, and government-funded projects. The state had to borrow either directly from European powers or from foreign-owned banks, often by farming out the revenue of much of the country's custom houses as collateral, a practice that temporarily helped the cash-starved government coffers. Earlier in 1892, under Nasser ad-Din Shah, the income from Iranian customs was assigned to the Imperial Bank of Persia to service a loan of £500,000, $2,500,000, that was secured to pay off the indemnity for the repeal of the tobacco concession to the Reji Company. After much back and forth, Amin ad-Dowleh had managed to negotiate a new loan from the Imperial Bank in exchange for the provincial tax receipts. The terms of this loan further obligated the government to ransom its meagre resources over the long term. As expected, much of the loan was squandered on state bureaucracy and the Shah's European tours. By 1898, Amin al-Dowleh's reformist agenda had effectively reached a dead end. He was left with no choice but to resign and retire to his estate in Gilan province, where in 1904 he died, a disillusioned man. In a broader context, Amin ad-Dowleh's dismissal marked the end of ministerial reforms from above, which at least since the middle of the 19th century had preoccupied such statesmen as Amir Kabir and Mashir ad-Dowleh. The alternative, a movement of dissent from below, which was long in gestation, soon evolved into a popular revolution. Upon Amin ad-Dowleh's dismissal, the Shah and his courtiers reverted back to the old ways, by calling on Amin al-Sultan to return to office, primarily to secure yet another loan, this time from Russia. The nearly bankrupt Iranian treasury secured a loan of £2,400,000, $12 million, from the Russian Mortgage Bank of Persia to pay off previous British loans, but at the heavy price of farming out nearly all the remaining Iranian customs revenue. A team of Belgian officials, who initially had been employed to supervise the administration of Iranian customs, gravitated toward the Russian authorities. Although they introduced new regulations, revised practices, and increased state revenue through the imposition of stricter tariffs, they were more loyal to the Russian creditors than to the Iranian government. The Iranian merchant community was already resentful of the ad valorem tax imposed on Iranians at a higher rate than the tariffs for European trading houses, a disadvantage rooted in the Turkmenchai Commercial Treaty. The doubling of customs duties under the Belgian administration only generated further discontent, but higher customs duties were only part of the problem. The greater part was a shift in trade patterns. In the last quarter of the 19th century, Iran's foreign imports, mostly commodities such as tea and sugar, as well as manufactured goods, including cotton and woolen fabrics, increased substantially. By 1900, Iran's population had reached 10 million, twice the size of the population a century earlier, and nearly 25% lived in cities. In the first decade of the 20th century, cotton fabrics, sugar, and tea constituted 61% of Iran's total imports. Sugar from Russia, France, and Austria amounted to 26% of all imports, with a value of $6,250,000. In the mid-1890s, Iran's estimated volume of foreign trade stood at $25 million, while total state revenue for the same period was no more than $12,500,000. The increase in the volume of imports was in contrast to a steady drop in the value of exports. Compared to the middle of the 19th century, by 1910, the value of Iran's three traditional export commodities, silk, opium, and cotton fabrics, had dropped in proportion to total trade by a massive 74%. The exports of raw cotton and carpets, however, had increased in value, but only by 26%. By 1910, Iran exported about $20 million and imported $25 million annually, causing a cumulative 20% deficit in the balance of its foreign trade. This imbalance contributed to a steady fall in the value of Iranian currency. Between 1875 and 1900, the Tuman depreciated 100% against the British pound, which triggered a rise in the price of imported goods in the domestic market and more vulnerability to international fluctuations. Early signs of discontent. By 1905, an increasing number of clandestine publications and makeshift posters on the gates of mosques and the walls of government buildings held the Shah and his government responsible for a deteriorating economy, rising prices, and mistreatment of the people of Iran. In response, the government of the Qajar prince, Ayn ad-Dowleh, who came to power to restore order and stabilize prices, resorted to draconian measures. As a symbolic gesture, the governor of Tehran ordered the arrest and bastinado of four merchants on the charge of cornering the sugar market and hiking prices. The public humiliation of reputable merchants had the adverse effect of bringing crowds to the Friday mosque in sympathy with the leaders of the bazaar. Yet there was still visible change from the time of the tobacco protest. The voices of dissent were more articulate in their critique of the state and, to a limited extent, in their vision for change. Already in 1900, Jamal ad-Din Isfahani had published a tract in Shiraz titled Libas-e-Takva, an attire of virtue, calling on the Iranian public to wear domestic clothing and avoid imported European fabrics. He pleaded with Iranian merchants to join forces against European competition by consolidating their capital in commercial companies and urged them to manufacture fabrics domestically. Engaging in such activities, rather than entering into war with guns and rifles, was the true jihad and citizens' patriotic duty. Earlier, Jamal ad-Din, in collaboration with his Babi associates in Isfahan, had organized the Progress Society, Anjaman-e-Taraghi, one of the earliest pre-revolutionary secret circles. The society was instrumental in persuading Isfahani merchants to establish a public company known as the Islamic Company, Sherekat-e Islamiye, to issue stocks and to raise the necessary resources to set up mills and manufacture clothing for domestic consumption. Creation of commercial companies, known as compagnie and later Sherekat, with shareholders, was a novel concept that was accepted only gradually at the turn of the 20th century. Traditionally, Islamic law recognized only individuals, not shared entities, as legitimate legal personalities. The formation of new companies and the higher volume of investment in them no doubt added to merchants' economic power, but it also exposed more of them to the vagaries of the market, commitment to larger loans from modern banks, and vacillations in international trade. In due course, this budding commercial bourgeoisie placed new demands on the state and contributed to the growing public discontent. Later, Jamal ad-Din directed his criticism toward both the Qajar elite and the clerical establishments, whom he held to be exploitative, corrupt, and tyrannical masters of the country. In 1903, he and Nasrullah Beheshti, better known as Malek al-Motekal Emin, another crypto-Babi cleric in the Isfahan circle, and later a celebrated preacher of the constitutional revolution, anonymously published the tract Royaye Sadege, A Truthful Dream, a satirical reproof of the mujtahids of Isfahan, especially Aga Najafi, as well as the powerful prince-governor of Isfahan, Zell al-Sultan. Here, the mujtahids of the city were depicted as a bunch of greedy, arrogant, and poorly trained mullahs, who swindled people's land and property to accumulate enormous wealth for themselves and their families, and who accepted bribes and favours from the rich and the powerful to issue partial, even conflicting, rulings. He accused them of collaborating with the oppressive and violent government to squash the weak and suppress alternative voices by wielding their weapon of takfir, excommunication, to kill, plunder, and appropriate property. The self-aggrandizing and self-indulgent mujtahids of Isfahan, the tract claimed, were hoarding grain in their silos, hiking prices, and committing racketeering. All the while, starving people were dying in the streets. It further characterized the mujtahids as reactionaries and accused them of opposing any social change as non-Islamic, including modern education, the learning of foreign languages, and contact with non-Shi'is, let alone with non-Muslims, whom they considered ritually unclean. All reforms that potentially affected the individual or communal privileges of the clergy, the authors declared, were branded by these pseudo-scholars as evil, and they called for their punishment. The clergy were blamed for their demagogic grip on their ignorant following, whom the mujtahids exhorted to zealotry and violence. Throngs of seminarians, talabeh, and urban brigands, lutis, served as their vigilantes. Writing in the familiar genre of the dream narrative, Jamal ad-Din employed a theatrical dialogue to scandalize the mujtahid's deceit and hypocrisy. Even on the Day of Judgment, which is the stage on which Jamal ad-Din's narrative is played out, Najafi employs his crafty rhetorical skills, all in colloquial Isfahani accent, to bargain with God his own salvation during the final reckoning. Such lampooning of the clergy was not entirely new in Persian literature, yet here, for the first time, the semi-clandestine publication brought criticism out into the open and made it available to a wider public in poignant and accessible language. Though the print run of the earliest edition of the Royaye Sadage was no more than a mere 80 copies, it had an impact on the Iranian audience. In their later sermons, Jamal ad-Din and his fellow preachers were more respectful of the heads. They praised the two progressive clerical leaders of the constitutional revolution, Sayyid Muhammad Tabatabai and Sayyid Abdullah Behbahani, for upholding the nation, protecting the interests of the motherland, and defending the constitution. Instead, the thrust of Jamal ad-Din Isfahani's later criticism, at the outset of the revolution, was shifted toward the state and the conservative Qajar elite and their allies. From 1907 until his murder after the coup of 1908, a newspaper named after him, Al-Jamal, published his sermons in Tehran to be distributed to a wider audience throughout the country. This was a clear example of how the press and mass communication transformed clandestine dissent into a revolutionary discourse. The most progressive preachers, journalists, and activists shared their criticism of the conservative Qajar aristocracy and the high clergy, though seldom by name, favouring instead the pro-constitutional and the enlightened members of the state elite. Earlier critics like Malcolm, Afghani and Kermani, and the moderate Yusuf Khan Mojtahar al-Dowleh, considered such a course a tactical necessity. The latter was the author of the critical tract Yek Kalameh, a single word, among the earliest in this genre, published in 1871. It advocated the constitution as the remedy to the country's ailments, aiming to reconcile the preamble to the French constitution with Islamic principles. Mojtahar al-Dowleh offered a very liberal reading of Islamic theology and law in defence of the rule of law, human and civil rights, and limits on the state's power. His comparative approach found little following at the time, but no doubt it later influenced the framers of the Iranian constitution. Mojtahar al-Dowleh's facility pairing articles of the French constitution with Quranic verses and the Islamic hadith may not have always met the jurist's seal of approval, but it was sufficient to later persuade the Iranian constitutionalists, many of them laymen, not to leave the task of interpreting Sharia entirely to the jurists. By the time of the constitutional revolution, a trend within the Iranian opposition indeed articulated an Islamic discourse similar to that of Mojtahar al-Dowleh. Preachers and activists, some with a latent Babi Azali affiliation, were ready to offer their support to moderate mojtahids such as Sayyid Muhammad Tabatabai, 1842-1920, and Sayyid Abdullah Behbahani, 1840-1910, as a realistic way to rock the weakling Qajar state. The shift within the Babi Azali camp, which had become radical since the 1880s, after Yahyur Sobeh Azal endorsed call for an anti-Qajar revolt, allowed for the concealment of past Babi affinities, an act of disguise, taqiyyah, in a moment of danger that is fully endorsed by the Shi'i legal tradition and, by implication, by the Babi Azalis. 50 years of persecution at the hands of the Ulama and the state convinced them that a dual challenge to the Qajar state and the Shi'i establishment was untenable. They were, however, receptive to the notions of democracy, representation, and even republicanism, which they felt were in harmony with the essence of the Babi beliefs, and they were eager to share their invigorated political dissent with sympathetic Shi'i authorities. In contrast, the Baha'is, who accounted for the majority of those stigmatized under the general rubric of the Babi heresy, remained largely uninvolved and often resolved to disclose their religious identity, a conviction that resulted in tragic bouts of secure persecution. The sporadic mob brutalities committed against the Baha'is in the late 19th and early 20th centuries were frequently provoked by ambitious mojtahids and carried out by their followers. The growth of these anti-Baha'i campaigns may be attributed to the mojtahids losing ground to more liberal voices outside and within the religious community. They viewed conversion to the new faith, an avenue to religious modernity for many lay people and for members of the clerical class critical of the Shi'i establishment, with great anxiety. The atrocities were often condoned by the Qajar government and its local agents, who were either helpless to stop them or perhaps more often saw a chance to enhance their public image as disseminators of heresy and as upholders of the true Islamic faith. Such hysteria took place in the city of Yazd in 1902-1903, when a frantic mob led by lutis and equipped with fatwas of the local mojtahids from over a period of months attacked and looted Baha'i households and businesses and arrested and executed as many as 100 Baha'is. These acts were committed in public and in the most gruesome fashion. The victims, mostly artisans and small-scale tradesmen, but also a few affluent merchants, paid not only with their lives, but also with the lives of their wives and children. Some Baha'i women were forced to convert back to Islam and were duly married off to their Muslim tormentors. Those who resisted were raped and chased out of the city. Children were enslaved or abandoned, and helpless families died of thirst and starvation on remote back roads hundreds of miles from their homes. Muhammad Ali Jamalzadeh, 1892-1997, a renowned Iranian writer of the 20th century and son of the aforementioned Sayyid Jamal ad-Din Isfahani, recalled a haunting sight of the Baha'i refugees from Yazd dying of hunger at the outskirts of a village near Kashan. Together with his mother, the young Jamalzadeh was himself fleeing a vicious anti-Babi campaign in Isfahan. The ferocity of the Yazd persecution, one of several at the time, only confirmed the Babi Azali incentive for Taqiyyeh, if for no other reason than security. As a result of concealing their identity, many Azalis inevitably were assimilated into the majority Muslim population at the expense of the gradual fading away of their Babi identity. Yet assimilation in many cases did not soften their anti-Qajar agenda. As the popular constitutional movement gradually gained momentum, Babi sympathizers among the lower clerical ranks gravitated toward political activism, which was wrapped safely in the guise of Islamic conformity. From the House of Justice to the National Assembly. The dissidents in exile had only an indirect impact on the course of the constitutional movement, and this was mostly through domestic activists. Enjoying the blessing of two high-ranking mujtahids, Behbahani and Tabatabai, the activists among middle and lower-ranking mullahs made more demands on the state. This helped turn an initially limited protest movement with mundane aims into a national outcry for a constitution, popular representation, and civil rights. These ideas, adopted by a handful of advocates from such sources as Malcolm Khan's Qanun and the fictional travelogue Ibrahim Beg by Marageyi, were communicated to high-ranking clerical leaders and then passed down to the general public. Sayyid Muhammad Tabatabai's support for constitutionalism, rooted in his admirably liberal predilections, was atypical among the jurists of the period. His ally, Sayyid Abdollah Behbahani, however, seemed to have been driven as much by ambitions of leadership and alleged monetary concerns as by aspirations for democracy. Both leaders belonged to families who had enjoyed social distinction for more than a century. At the outset, they relied heavily on their better-informed subordinates for their knowledge of such notions as civil rights, legislation, and national sovereignty. But their courage and prestige made them enormously popular with the public. Tabatabai, in particular, was endowed with a genuine urge to establish a pluralistic society based on rule of law and individual freedoms, concepts that he himself acknowledged as inconsistent with the best interests of the mujtahid class. The early absence of a coherent political agenda among the protesters is evident, for instance, in the set of demands set forth in December 1905 during the Bast sanctuary that was organized in response to the government's treatment of sugar merchants. The most significant demand was a call to establish a House of Justice, Adalat Khane, which would be compatible with Sharia and would protect subjects from the state's arbitrary measures, especially in collecting taxes. Yet the list of demands also included such seemingly mundane items as dismissal of a notorious carriage driver who monopolized the route between Tehran and the nearby shrine of Shah Abd al-Azim, and whose uncouth conduct generated many complaints from the pilgrims. No mention, however, was made of the Qanun, law or constitution, division of powers, or creation of a legislative assembly. Even the concept of the House of Justice was not particularly favoured by many, for it implied a potential departure from the decentralised judicial courts that the ulama had long cherished. The notion of the House of Justice, which eventually transformed into a call for a national assembly, had its roots in the writings of the Bab and the messianic aspiration to establish a House of Justice, Bayt al-Adl, under the Imam of the Age. That the beginning of the constitutional movement in A.H. 1323, 1905 CE, was only 6 years before the millennial anniversary of the Greater Occultation, Gebate Kobra, of the Hidden Imam, who was presumed to have gone into occultation in A.H. 329, 941 CE, added to the messianic spirit of the moment and to anticipation of the return of the Mahdi. This was evident in many statements, names of a number of newspapers, and the sermons of the pro-constitutional preachers. In effect, the awakening, bidari, of the people, often referred to in the literature of the period, and their demand for the establishment of a just order, implied some form of modernization, or more specifically, democratization, of a messianic paradigm and its utopian ideals that were indigenous to the Iranian environment. Dispensing justice, adl and adalat, in the world to redress wrongs and remove tyranny, one of the precepts of Shi'i Islam with a millenarian connotation, was soon adopted by a new generation of European-educated state elites and complemented by European notions of the rule of law and limits on the despotic power of the state. Domesticating these Western notions in the Shi'i political space enabled the growth and early success of the constitutional movement. Yet, from the start, it also injected into the process inherent ambiguity, even some resistance to divulging the true secular agenda of the constitutionalists. By somewhat naively trying to dress many articles of the emerging constitution in Islamic garb, not dissimilar to Mustahara Dowleh's Yek Kalameh, the constitutional activists hoped to appease the conservative and escape labels of heresy and religious innovation. As such, they introduced a troubling feature to the Iranian experience of democracy, one that would remain inherent for decades, if not for a whole century thereafter. The Yosef Noz affair offered a pretext for expressing indignation at and discontent with foreign presence. As the Belgian director of Iranian customs under Mozaffaruddin Shah since 1897, Noz had restructured Iranian customs and raised state revenue through higher tariffs and the rigorous collection of duties. Yet public discontent with his regime was expressed in Islamic ethical terms. He had appeared at a European costume ball in Tehran in Persian traditional attire, remotely resembling that of the ulama. The widely distributed photograph of him in costume, smoking the Persian water pipe, became a source of outrage, and his dismissal one of the demands of the protesters in Qom. The protest was fueled, and possibly financed, by Iranian merchants resentful of Noz's discriminatory practices, which favoured Russian firms. His partiality to Russia was reciprocated by Russia's extending near-protégé status to Belgians and threatening the Iranian government with retaliation for any action taken against Noz's practices or against his amassing of personal wealth. Yet, even after his departure in May 1907, the outcome of public protest, the Belgians' grip on customs remained firm. In July 1906, a renewed call for the government to convene a Sharia-bound assembly, Majlis, of the House of Justice, regained momentum. In support of the Majlis, the restive Tehran population gathered in Tabkhane Square, Meydane Tabkhane, adjacent to the Citadel complex, and staged one of the earliest public demonstrations that had occurred outside the mosque or the shrine setting. The clampdown on demonstrators by government troops resulted in the death of a young religious student, offering a pretext to a group of pro-constitutionalist ulama headed by Tabatabai to leave the capital and reside in Qom. The ulama's departure in protest was always treated with anxiety by the Qajar government, especially in times of crisis. Simultaneously, the merchants of the Tehran Bazaar rallied behind Behbahani, who had ties with the British legation in Tehran, playing a crucial role in the burgeoning protest movement. Fearing government retaliation, the Tehran merchants managed to organize a vast sanctuary, Bast, in support of the Qom protesters in the safety of the British legation in Tehran. Taking sanctuary in the grounds of a European power was an unprecedented, even sacrilegious move, more so because it was in the British legation that the protesters openly demanded for the first time the establishment of a constitutional Mashrute order. The Bast attracted a crowd from all walks of life, particularly from the bazaar guilds, small merchants, and artisans. Altogether, there were about 500 tents representing trades and professions, as humble as cobblers, porcelain menders, and fresh walnut vendors. On the final day, as many as 14,000 individuals participated. The atmosphere was joyous but orderly, and the mood congenial and optimistic. The chief merchants of the bazaar sustained the cost of the tent and food for the public for the full 2 weeks of the Bast. Massive copper cauldrons were brought from the mosques and the tekiyes and placed on makeshift hearths in a common kitchen to prepare huge quantities of rice, stew, and Persian ash, which were delivered on trays to the tents, whose banners identified guilds and other organizations. There were also frequent sermons and speeches highlighting the evils of tyranny and the benefits of a constitution. The protest was novel, above all, because of the central role of the merchants. They took the lead from constitutional activists in persuading the ranking mojtahids to comply with the idea of the constitution. Even more than the tobacco protest 15 years earlier, the merchant class was the engine behind the protesters and the voicing of their grievances. Moreover, the Bast enjoyed the tacit support of some middle-ranking British diplomats in Tehran. Facing the protesters' enthusiasm and their growing numbers, British diplomats could do little but allow the Bast to proceed unhindered. The British blessing, momentary though it was, hinted toward a shift in the British Foreign Office's policy in Iran under Sir Edward Grey, a subtle response to Russia's increasing commercial and political influence in Iran and to the Qajar court's tilt toward its northern neighbour. As far as the constitutionalists were concerned, the Bast in the legation offered not only immunity against the government and the blessing of a European power, but also a secular space, one outside the mosque and religious sanctuaries. The relative freedom in the new space allowed Western-educated intellectuals and graduates of the Dar al-Funun to help refashion the idea of the House of Justice into a demand for a European-style constitution. The coinage mashrute, in fact, meant conditional, denoting the setting of conditions on the power of the sovereign. Borrowed from the neighbouring Ottoman Empire's first constitutional regime of 1876, which was aborted in 1878 by Sultan Abd al-Hamid, meshrutiyet, as it pronounced in Ottoman Turkish, represented for the Iranians more than just the new conditional system. It represented the entire constitutional experience and political order it entailed. The term mashrute, moreover, implies a familiar chapter on conditions, shurut, in Islamic law, which in turn gave it a certain Islamic acceptability, and in the eyes of the ulama and the public, put it at a safe distance from such alien notions as constitution and constitutionalism. Public debate and publications further gave the term mashrute and associated buzzwords a greater currency. The growing telegraphic communications throughout Iran's major cities made it possible for protesters in the capital to transmit the constitutional message of the movement and to coordinate their efforts with cohorts in Tabriz, the true center of radical activism, and elsewhere. Thus, the movement was no longer seen as a quarrel between the ulama and the Qajar state. It had acquired a nationwide constituency that was increasingly becoming conscious of its message and its national identity. Long live Iran! A rallying cry of the constitutionalists from the earliest days touched on such patriotic sentiments. As has often been noted, only a small number of the elite understood the idea of the constitution and the liberal values associated with it. Yet the Iranian public was quick to employ the term to air its resentment of their destitution, material decline, and the insecurities they faced in everyday life. For these ills, the people held the ruling establishment responsible. If notions of constitutional rights and democratic representation were new to them, poverty, decline, and state arbitrary rule were familiar. It is rather naive to blame the ordinary people, as critics of the constitutional revolution often have, for their unfamiliarity with the lofty liberal ideals of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Montesquieu, or John Stuart Mill. It is even more condescending to expect that all revolutions would have a standard interpretation of modernity.